Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. And Dan, thank you very much for your introduction. I'm really pleased to have the chance to be here with you because, as you understand from my CV, I spent my whole life as a professional diplomat. That means I talk to colleagues of mine, to professional diplomats most of the time, but it's always useful to talk to people like you and to get the feedback from you. What do you think about foreign policy? How do you see the questions, problems? How do you see our efforts, our activities? By the way, I'm very pleased to see one of my distinguished friends and colleagues, Ambassador Wolfgang Petrić, who was one of my predecessors, the high representative in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it only confirms that the diplomatic world is really small. There is no place you will not find a friend. So feel free to ask questions, because it's up to you to decide what's most interesting for you. The topic of my presentation is called Foreign Policy in a New Global Era, Perspective from Slovak Foreign Minister. So it's quite wide, and therefore I will be shooting the issues upon you and then wait for you to come back with your comments, with your questions. And thank you, Dan, for introducing my country, so you helped me to, and you made it possible for me to skip part of my introduction, because I really believe it's important for you to know where do I come from. My country, Slovakia, used to be part of Czechoslovakia. We are 20 years old this year, which gives us many reasons to celebrate and also to look back and to see what has been achieved. And it was not a little. The fact is that 20 years ago we were on the agenda for EU and NATO. Now we are at the table and discussing other issues, other countries. 20 years ago we were at the periphery of Europe. Now we are in the very core, not only being the member of European Union and NATO, but also being members of Schengen, border free zone, and member of the Eurozone. That means using euro as our currency. 20 years ago we were asking the NATO to protect us. Now we are protecting the others. We are acting together with other NATO allies in Afghanistan, in other countries. And 20 years ago we were receiving official assistance from other countries. Now we have just celebrated 10 years since we've started providing our official development assistance of Slovakia. So we are a country that has achieved a lot in these 20 years. Next year will be another year of celebrations, because we will have 25 years since what is known as the end or the fall of the Berlin Wall. And for us it's 25 years since the Velvet Revolution in former Czechoslovakia, and also 10 years since our membership in European Union and NATO. But it was not only Slovakia that changed itself so much in the last 20 years, but the European Union did the same as well. European Union, broadly speaking, was facing three big challenges throughout these years: internal, external, and unexpected. The internal one was how to integrate more, to become more efficient, because as EU project was born with six countries, and then later 9, 12. It was still more of a fire club discussions about big issues, but then it grew larger up to 15 and then 27 countries, now 28. It developed into an economic giant, and it was necessary for EU to be ready to react to the global developments in real time, which was one of the problems. So that meant need for greater integration. At the same time, new countries were knocking on the EU's doors, asking for membership. It means enlargement. That means you had vertical and horizontal processes at the same time. That was one of the challenges. The second challenge was, as I said, external, how to be a real global player, because EU became the largest market, common market in the world, the largest investor in the world, the largest donor in the world, largest provider of official development assistance and humanitarian assistance in the world. But this economic power did not coincide with the political influence. And the European Union was teased a number of times for being an economic giant but political dwarf. And we were also seen as payer but not a player. And this was not a good place to be. So obviously EU was undertaking measures and efforts to become also a political player in accordance with its economic power. So let me just remind you of the key steps that were undertaken in this regard. First, the Maastricht Treaty, which transformed European Community into European Union 20 years ago, 1st of November 1993. And that treaty also laid foundations for common European foreign policy. The so-called CFSP, Common Foreign and Security Policy of the European Union, and ESDP, European Security and Defence Policy was established, and also the first attempt to formulate common foreign policy for the European Union. Then the Amsterdam Treaty, 1997, that introduced the position of the High Representative for the foreign policy. So first attempt to give one face, one name to the European foreign policy. Then we were quite ambitious, wanted to change our basic treaties and to adopt European constitutions, but that failed because of the referendums in France and in Netherlands. But we tried to save what was agreeable to all of us, and the Lisbon Treaty was adopted, which was the latest change of the basic treaties that founded the European Union. And the Lisbon Treaty entered into force 2010. It was adopted 2009. And Lisbon brought many changes, particularly to the area of foreign policy, namely establishing the double-headed position of the High Representative for European foreign policy, the position that is held by Lady Catherine Ashton, and which much greater competencies compared to Javier Solana, and what was even more important, established for the first time European Foreign Service, which is called European External Action Service, but it means diplomatic arm of the European Union. Right now this Foreign Service operates in 139 countries, so we have European delegations in these countries, out of which there are 70 countries where less than 10 EU member states have their individual embassies, and 50 countries where less than 5 EU member states have their embassies. But we are present in these countries thanks to the presence of EU delegations. What's also important in this project is that it really merges the structures of the European Union and the national member state structures. Right now the composition of diplomats in this external action service is 60% of experts coming from Brussels structures and 30 plus person coming from member states. So it gives the feeling of ownership to the member states because they are part of this service, and it also gives the feeling of responsibility to those who are coming from structures because they understand that they are also responsible to individual member states. It's a unique project. I'm quite enthusiastic about it because I, as you heard, was part of the top management of this service for 1.5 years. I was responsible for Europe and Central Asia, and I really see this as a wonderful project. It's still a work in progress because it started something which will end up, which I'm quite convinced, in joint European diplomatic representations. We are speaking about European houses. For example, I'm going to open embassy in Georgia, Tbilisi, because we are not present there. But instead of buying or renting a house and arranging all that comes with it, I've arranged with the EU delegation to rent 2 office spaces. I'll send a person who will be formally ambassador, but will be residing in their space. And of course, what's also important, sharing of information, sharing of contacts. Why do we have to have 15 or 20 embassies in a place like Jakarta, Indonesia, each of them doing the political reporting and sending to all of us? Isn't it better to have one set of information which will be produced jointly and shared among all of us to make sure that we all speak with one voice? And whenever we have a common European position, and it's more often than it has ever been, it's only easier that we communicate the same messages. Right now, every time I travel to countries outside of the European Union, I receive lines to take and messages from this external action service. So that I speak always in my sort of double-headed capacity, national and European. And this is what makes EU more visible, and of course what makes our voice more powerful. A couple of practical examples of the changing role of the European Union. Balkans, in the first place. Look, 20 years ago, European Union failed to stop the war in former Yugoslavia, and it had to be the US who came in to the rescue, who stopped the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Nowadays, all the countries of former Yugoslavia are on their way to the membership in the European Union, and this process is fully led and controlled by the European Union. As you know, Croatia just joined the European Union this year as member number 28. Montenegro is in the process of negotiations. Montenegro is an interesting case because it's one of the successor states of former Yugoslavia that was born as a result of a negotiated process without any divisions, without any conflicts, without any bloodshed. They asked European Union to be in control and in the lead of this process. And it happened to be me who was appointed by Javier Solana to oversee the referendum in Montenegro. So that's one of the examples of negotiations we can talk about later if you are interested. Now Montenegro is in the process of formal accession negotiations to the European Union. That means it's an irreversible process which ends with full membership. Serbia is expecting to get the invitation to start the process in January, or not later than in January. Kosovo, 1999, we had a NATO-led military intervention to former Yugoslavia and bombardment of Serbia to come to rescue to Kosovo. This year, it was Catherine Ashton who managed to achieve the breakthrough and landmark agreement between Belgrade and Pristina that makes it possible to pave the way for Kosovo to embark on the European integration path. And they are going to enter into the first stage, which is called stabilization and association process. And despite the fact that, you know, that as of today, Kosovo is recognized by 105 or 106 countries, and five out of 28 EU member states do not recognize Kosovo, including my country, nonetheless, everyone supports European perspective for Kosovo as a part of the region. Bosnia-Herzegovina, we can talk for days about that country. But what I want to say at this point is that, yes, it was the US who stopped the war. It was in the US military base in Dayton, 1995, where a peace accord was agreed. And one of its annexes is the current constitution of Bosnia-Herzegovina. But it's now the European Union who leads the negotiations about helping Bosnia-Herzegovina to move forward on its integration path. So European Union has become a true leader and moral authority in the Balkans. European Commission issues so-called progress reports annually, which is an assessment of the progress achieved or by each country since last 12 months. This is generally accepted as the standard assessment of each of these countries as a point of reference. So this is where we are in the Balkans. But another example could be the countries of Eastern Europe, former Soviet republics. After the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003 and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine 2004-2005, I would say that the attention of the West to this part of the world shifted away. But it was again the European Union that came in with new policy, which is called Eastern Partnership. This was officially launched 4 years ago. It addresses six of former Soviet republics: Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. This policy offers these countries three things: political association, economic integration, and visa liberalization. So, as you understand, it stops short of offering full membership in the European Union, but at the same time, it's open-ended. It does not say no to future membership. What we are saying is that the end game of this process will depend on what you will make out of it, how committed you are. So we will have the third summit of the Eastern Partnership end of November 28th, 29th in Vilnius. That means very soon. And here we expect to sign the association agreement and DCFTA, which is Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Area Agreement, with Ukraine, and to initial the same agreement with Moldova and with Georgia. During my times in Brussels, I was the chief negotiator for this agreement with Ukraine and with Moldova, and I initialed that agreement with Ukraine in March 2011. Initialing means basically confirming that the negotiations are completed, so the text has been agreed. And then, of course, with signing, you start the formal process of ratification and entering into force. We also have completed negotiations about this agreement with Armenia. But then we were all caught by surprise when Armenia announced that they are going to join the customs union with Belarus, Russia, and Kazakhstan. And later on, they intend to join the so-called Eurasian Union, which is a landmark project of integration of the post-Soviet space announced by President Putin. We are sad because, first of all, we really managed to conclude negotiations with Armenia. But you cannot be at the same time in both, because DCFTA association agreement is based on different technical standards as the customs union with these three countries, and therefore one excludes the other. So we will continue being friends with Armenia, but we know that there is a limit, there is a ceiling to our our F word, which is given by the fact that they are going to adjust their system to different standards. Nonetheless, we expect Vilnius to be a success, and we expect Vilnius to confirm sustainability of this project. So European Union is now a global player. No one would make any jokes about European Union anymore. That's clear. What's also important is that European Union serves as a model. This is this famous soft power, the ability to lead by example, the model to inspire. The fact is that European Union has been the most successful model of integration of countries in this world. There is no other place, other group of countries that have been more successful in achieving higher standards of political stability, economic prosperity, social protection, protection of human rights, human dignity. And this is why European Union is so attractive to a number of countries around this world, particularly to those in our neighborhood, but also to the others. So we are not imposing our models upon others. But all those who are willing to look to be like us, we offer our advice, our assistance, our partnership. And this is how it works. You know, we have our program for which is called European Neighborhood Policy, for 16 countries, 6 to the east and 10 to the south, countries of the Mediterranean. European Union is now in the lead for the global negotiations with Iran about Iranian nuclear program. You know that this so-called P5 plus 1 or E3 plus 3 process is led by Lady Ashton again. European Union is in the lead in operation in Africa, in Mali, or in Congo. And right now we've just launched a very comprehensive program of transformation in Burma, Myanmar. At the same time, I think you will agree with me that European Union is a global leader on a number of horizontal issues, such as climate change, development, disarmament, energy, water. So these are the areas where EU has the ambition and has become a global leader and trendsetter. What's also important is the partnership between the European Union and the United States. As I said, 20 years ago, the US was uncontested world leader. But it also takes lots of time and energy, and we were asked a number of times by our US friends to help them and to take care of our own affairs and of our neighborhood. So what is happening here and what I've just described to you about the EU role is not in contradiction with our partnership in the United States. On the contrary, when we are able to take care of our neighborhood, we free the United States capacities to deal with other issues. And this partnership is very unique. This partnership is based on the hard power, which is embodied by the United States, and the soft power of the European Union. And whenever and wherever it works, it functions perfectly. But it's extremely important that EU and US speak with one voice in a number of crisis areas all over the world. And this is how we try to work together. I would say we need each other because we complement each other. We, as I said, we are in the lead in the Balkans or in the Eastern Europe. United States is clearly in the lead in Middle East or in Asia, for example. And again, we don't see this as a problem because it does not shake the basics of our relationship and of our partnership. At the same time, that's the feeling that I got, well, some time ago, but it was reinforced during my 3 days I spent here in the United States, is nothing can be taken for granted. And I see US being, for me, too much absorbed with its internal politics. It's difficult to find people to talk about foreign policy, and it's which is not good, because US must not resign on its global responsibility and its role of as a global leader. And even in the European Union, we need to see the reconfirmation of this partnership, because this is one of the key elements of today's global architecture. So we apparently listen to each other, maybe more than we would like it in Europe, but it's not the same as to understand each other and to be able to get the feedback from each other. So one of my messages in my formal meetings that I had just the last 2-3 days in New York and Washington was for the US to get back as a global foreign policy player. I mentioned the third challenge EU has been facing as an unexpected one, which was the crisis. The crisis also showed how much intertwined, interdependent we are, because no other part of the world was affected so badly by the crisis as the European Union. And the crisis originated here with the fall of Lehman Brothers and other things. European Union was dealing with this crisis in two ways, solving or addressing the immediate causes of the crisis, and second, finding answers to of more systemic nature. So the first group of measures was to build a wall to protect our common currency, euro. We adopted something which was called the European Stability Mechanism, providing financial guarantees for all those countries who were facing problems to make sure that euro is robust enough and stable enough and cannot be threatened by problems in individual countries. We've introduced a number of other measures demanding greater responsibility in a fiscal area by individual countries. We are in the stage of something unprecedented, which is called European Semester, namely that we've adopted our national budget as a government and send it not to our parliament, but we send it to the European Commission for assessment. And it should come back 4 weeks, so we did it on 15th of October. By mid-November, we shall get it back with a public assessment, which will be put on the website of the European Commission, what they think about our budget proposal for the next year. And this was done by all 17 members of the Eurozone. And only after that we go to the national parliament. So they would. This is unprecedented because it shows how much we are interconnected, how important it is that each of the 17 governments maintains responsible and prudent fiscal policy. And it also shows the level of integration. And the second set of measures that have been undertaken are the ones that are, as I said, of more systemic nature, not only making sure that these problems will not occur again, but also making European Union even more competitive. Right now we speak about such a level of European integration that was unthinkable of 3 years ago. We speak about banking union, that means creating one single banking authority that will have the right and the capacity to intervene whenever they detect problems with individual banks in individual member states. We speak about fiscal union, that means it's not possible to have 17 countries with one currency but with 17 different and independent fiscal policies. It really cannot work like this. We speak about economic union, which is our plan to for greater coordination of our economic instruments, such as taxes, for example. And the fourth pillar of this new European architecture is called democratic legitimacy, to bring European policies closer to our citizens, because as brilliant as our ideas could be, they will fail as long as they do not enjoy the support of our citizens. And they cannot support them if they don't understand them. So to bring the European institutions closer to our citizens is extremely, extremely important. So this is where we are. It's clear that Europe after the crisis will be different from Europe before the crisis. It will be much more and much more deeply integrated, but at the same time it will be much less homogeneous. We were speaking 3 years ago with many question marks about possibility of two-speed Europe. Here we are with European Union with several speeds, because it's really clear that not everyone is either willing or able to follow the speed and to follow the path of deeper integration. So what we're trying to do now is, of course, to make sure that the least enthusiastic ones will not block those who are willing to move further, but at the same time to make sure that European Union will not turn into a train with first class and second class coaches. That means there has to be flexibility, and those who will decide to join later this elite club, the Eurozone club, the zone of the core integration, will be able to do so still. So these are the challenges that we are facing right now. Now, what are the other challenges for the European Union? Growth versus austerity. This is an eternal issue. How to execute prudent, responsible fiscal policy to cut expenses, but at the same time not to suffocate the economy. How to square the circle between austerity and growth? Job creations. Second, European Union social model versus European Union's global competitiveness. European Union represents today some 7% of the world's population, 25% of the world's GDP, and 50% of world's social spendings. which says a lot about our global competitiveness and how to maintain it in a long-term perspective. And of course, unemployment, and particularly young unemployment, is a serious problem which we are trying to address to make sure that every graduate from the high school, college, university will either get a job or will have the chance to continue his education or to get an extra specialization. But within 4 months, no one should be, or everyone should be somehow placed on the job market. That's really important. At the same time, we are, and this is what the crisis is good for, we are fighting fraud and tax evasions because we need, of course, to stop this. We are trying to complete our internal market. There is still space, particularly in services, in digital market. We are liberalizing energy market, and we are liberalizing also the global trade. And here the famous TTIP comes into question, because this will be the major agreement between the European Union and the United States, which shall create some 2 million extra jobs, some $160 billion for the European Union, $130 billion for the United States. And this will be the largest free trade area in the world, and its importance goes well beyond trade and economy, because it will also be a very strong and very powerful signal, first about EU-US partnership, about our adherence to free trade, and it will set a global trends, I would say, the global standards for the others. In final part of my presentation, I was asked to mention briefly, well, the current global problems, and I was asked to identify if there are any similarities between the problems, challenges the Balkans were facing in the 90s and the current global world is facing. I would say it's it's difficult to find these similarities, because what is the same are the aspirations of people for freedom, for democracy, for protection of their human rights, and also the fact that each society, each fabric is complicated. But what is happening in the world right now takes place in a different internal and external environment. And therefore, it's really important to understand that we are dealing with people with different culture, with different political historic legacy. And as I said, all this is happening in different environments. Speaking about Arab Spring, well, my Turkish colleague recently told me that 2011 was the year of hope, 2012 was the year of elections, and 2013 is the year of disappointment. This is what's happening in that part of the world. The new phenomena, interstate conflicts being replaced by intrastate conflicts, but with a huge potential for a spillover, because whatever is happening in Syria or in Egypt has a dramatic impact on the neighborhood, on the region, and even wider. And second, that the democratic processes could produce not so democratic results. Look at Egypt. President Morsi was elected in a free, fair elections, but then he was dismissed by a popular movement because the way he was running the country was seen as largely not acceptable by his own citizens. Speaking about Syria, we lost 2.5 years because of the inability of the UN Security Council to live up to its role and to its responsibility. I'm really pleased that now the process is back on the political track, on the diplomatic track. We were on the verge of military action, but there is no military solution. I mean, even if there is a military action, it should be followed by political negotiations anyway. So if we can avoid that military part, so much the better for all the partners. We are trying to get the parties at the negotiating table, which is called Geneva II. Not so easy. End of November, now we speak about December. Now, questions, what we do if we don't get them there? Or another fundamental question, what we do if they are there? What are our expectations for the negotiations? Middle East peace process, we are extremely grateful to the United States, Secretary Kerry, for being able to restart the process. It's very fragile, very sensitive. EU is here to support by the means that US will find useful from our part. Iran, you are aware of the new leadership in that country, new signals. readiness to negotiate, readiness to prove that we were wrong in assessing the potential of their nuclear program. It's them who raises the expectations. It's them who is saying we need less than 1 year to show that we that there is nothing wrong with our program. So trust but verify is probably the principle under which we are now conducting our negotiations with Iran. And my final point here is probably the lessons learned by myself and the conclusions that I draw by myself from my experience in Montenegro, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Albania, in Brussels. Whenever there are crisis situations, they are each of them is different. But I have formulated 4 points which I believe are credible and relevant. First, don't push for ideal solution. Don't come in with a pre-designed solution. If it worked in one part of the world, it does not mean it will work in a different part of the world. Respect the local environment, mentality, culture, history. Sounds very simple, but Wolfgang would confirm that it's not so easy, and it happens more than once that international community is coming in with the blueprints of solutions, and then we are surprised why it doesn't work. My second point is called support the process, not the actors. And again, we tend to identify good guys, and we tend to support good guys, and then we tend to close our eyes whenever they do something which is not so good, but since they are good guys, we support them. And the so-called bad guys, we tend to ignore whatever they do because we've already labeled them bad guys. Support the process, principles, be impartial, get the trust of all the parties. My point number three, proceed from simple to more difficult issues, create a feeling of ownership. And this is what works so well in Montenegro. We prepared a special law consisting of 8 paragraphs. 3 of them are extremely important to set the date for the referendum, to formulate the question for the referendum, and the most difficult one, to define the threshold for the referendum. But by the time we got there, we've already had an agreement on the other 5. Such as the campaign, financing, media, and so on. And there was a strong feeling of ownership of parties, and they already knew that they accumulated something which they didn't want to lose. So in the end, it all worked. And the fourth point, keep the unity and support of the international community. Because every time you act on behalf of the international community, you spend more than half of your time and effort to negotiate with the international community, who is supposed to back you. But, you know, usually the international community is all over the place, and it's very difficult to act on behalf of the international community when one part of the international community is telling you this was not enough, and the other part is saying this was too much, you should be more prudent. So, therefore, international community's unity is the key. And in most of the problems where we are still in search for solutions, one of the answers is that we don't know what the solution should be because we have different versions of solutions on the different parts of the international community. So it's really impossible to deliver a solution. Nonetheless, being a diplomat, I sincerely believe in political and diplomatic solutions. I understand that sometimes military solutions are unavoidable. Sometimes even the threat of military action, like it was recently with Syria, helps to achieve or to get political process back on track. So we diplomats and the soldiers do have to work hand in hand and very closely, but I do advocate and will continue advocating for political and diplomatic solutions. And with this, I will stop here and to offer you time for and place for your question. Thank you very much.